Welcome to Technology Tandems. We get leaders together to discuss important tech of today and the implications for tomorrow. Our discussions are fun, lighthearted, and frankly opinionated, but hopefully gives you a sense of what matters, what to pay attention to, and what to ignore. Today on Technology Tandems, I have some fun topics for us. Today I want to talk about AI and writing code in the corporate environment, the good, the bad, and the ugly there, Jason. I want to talk about how that is really creating a level of complexity for CIOs that I don't think they're used to, and the challenges they're going to face around that. I think the consequence of this we'll get to is really around a new way of working, a new development methodology that's something that's sort of post-agile, if you will, and why I believe that. And I think, Jason, I'll be curious to hear some of your perspectives on this as well. And then finally, I want to wrap up with sort of the good of it too. You know, I think the first half or two-thirds of this pod will be a little bit about like what are the challenges that AI are bringing. But I do want to talk about some of the opportunities that it's bringing and the different ways that it will enable us to do really difficult things today a little bit easier. And I think that's kind of a neat thing for us to talk about. So to kick it off, let's start off at the top of that list, shall we, Jason?
Let's do it.
We're going to do something a little esoteric today, I suspect.
Okay.
It is in the hot topic that nobody can get enough of these days, namely AI.
What? I haven't heard of it. No, I'm
kidding. Let me tell you what AI is, Jason. Like,
is there anything that has been in the news other than it's the question?
That is a great question. And since AI wrote all the news, no, there is not. Look, I want to kick off with this article I read in the Wall Street Journal. It was in the CIO Journal specifically. And it was entitled, AI is writing code now for companies that is good and bad. It goes on to quote a variety of metrics that I thought were quite interesting about how generative AI coding tools, things like, what is it called?
Copilot. Tab 9.
Yeah.
Code Whisperer.
Thank you. Things like Copilot have really changed the game for developers. We're seeing pretty large efficiency gains. I read one A-B test that showed a 30 to 40% improvement in developer efficiency because you can effectively ask it to do things that are standard everyday tasks that you do over and over again. However, it just does it for you. So for example, if you have sent an email, you're probably going to write an integrate with some Twilio API, for example, or send a phone call or a text message. That needs to be done in whatever language you're running in, Go, Rust, JavaScript. Well, guess what? It just can do that for you. And that's a nice little efficiency gain. Nothing revolutionary. You could do that on Stack Overflow or other coding websites, but now it just does it. No Googling, no searching, no copying and pasting. In fact, IT leaders at United Airlines, Johnson & Johnson, Visa, Cardinal Health, Goldman Sachs, the list goes on and on and on, have been starting to use these tools to automate certain parts of their code writing process. I think the risk here goes back to that original Google paper that everybody loves to quote, which is that machine learning in this case, or AI if you want to call it that, is the high interest credit card of technical debt. And in fact, they say the same. That is, the potential for increased technical debt and orphan code is always a concern when delivery can be accelerated. That's what the state chief data officer of Truist said. And that while people have talked about technical debt for a long time, we have this brand new credit card, referencing that paper again, and there are a ton of new ways to use that credit card. We have no idea what the debt's going to be long-term. So with all of that set up, Jason, I just want to kick it over to you. What is your position on using these tools as developers? Both, I guess you could talk a little bit about what our experience has been and your thinking there, but then more broadly in the industry. Is this a good thing or is this a bad thing, or as the article said, for good and bad?
Well, I think it's a natural evolution. We started writing software by wiring up hardware, and then we went to punch cards and then assembly and then C and then what we called the 4GLs. And, you know, there are evolutions there. The same with the tool set. Like, we started with line editors, and, you know, then we had full text editors, and then we have these IDEs, and the IDEs do autocomplete and auto refactoring and generate test cases and methods. And, I see this as a natural evolution of using the AIs to help fill in a lot of that boilerplate, right? It's a big problem with a lot of code, or things that are just, you know, not value add, not specific to your business. Your example of doing an email, sending an email, those type things. Testing is, I think, one where there's a lot of work and a lot of repetition that is, you know, doesn't require a lot of hefty thought around building, you know, good testing suites and having good test data. And I think those are all things that generative AIs can really have a big impact to developer productivity. I've seen studies showing from 30 to 50% improvement in productivity, which all sounds very reasonable to me. And that's in line with what previous enhancements in developer tooling have generated. And so I see this again as just the natural evolution.
Yeah, I think it's a great point. And I think that what's really interesting here is if it makes developers' experiences better in a tight labor market, which it still is a tight labor market, at least today. Now that might be changing, but at least today it's still tight. Those are probably good things for the organization. And so you'd expect organizations to be really leaning into that. It makes your people more effective. You need fewer of them to accomplish the same tasks. But there's a second order effect here too, which is that if you can decrease the barrier for programming in a reliant way, then more people can do quote unquote programming. Now, this is what's so interesting is that while you're making that overall productivity increase, that is your developers who are good and sort of traditional developers are doing that, and now you're bringing in more, and I hate this term, but citizen developers into the ecosystem. You have more people now who can do developing. It's actually making the job of the CIO arguably much harder and more complex. You have people who may not be used to thinking about all of the systems level architecture design, the security surfaces they're now exposing, and the additional risk that comes with all of those new people in this environment. And so I'm curious from, if you put on your CTO, CIO hat for a second, how do you start to begin to balance this potential lift in productivity? Because we all know that every CIO's backlog is super short, right? No, of course not. It's basically infinite. So you have a huge amount of work to be done. You have a tool that can let you get more work done, but it comes with some risks, I suppose.
Well, before I answer that, let me back up and just talk about the idea that, well, we're going to double the productivity or triple even the productivity of all these developers. Then all of a sudden, you know, everyone's going to be out of a job. I do think that fear is a little unfounded.
The robots are not taking our job.
Right. It's Jevons paradox, right? That the cheaper that something comes, the more of it you will actually use. And I would say that's, again, we've had this evolution to IDEs and new languages and new development tools, and that hasn't caused a reduction in the need for programmers over the last 20 years. And the need for programmers is exponentially increased over the last decade or two. And so I think that these efficiency gains will actually increase the demand. So that, I believe, is going to happen, which I think is what leads to your actual question, which was, well, okay, well, now we have a lot of citizen developers or people that are relying on these tools that maybe didn't have the same background. And does that create a risk for companies in that they are, you know, might potentially take the AI suggestions and not recognize problems with it, right? Might not recognize security problems with it, might not recognize performance problems with it. I do think that that could happen. It goes back to the couple podcasts ago, Kevin and I got into a little argument about this. And, you know, my comment then was, you know, having a calculator and a spreadsheet does not immediately make you an accountant. You have to understand some of those underlying accounting concepts like depreciation, which I don't understand, and some of those things.
You just write it off.
Yeah.
That's the write it off. Anything you don't want to pay for, you just write it off.
Oh, my daughter loves that from, what's that? Schitt's Creek, I think. He's like, we just send it to the write-off. To the write-off people. That's what my daughter says to me. To send it to the write-off people. You know, you have to understand some of those foundational concepts. It does actually raise an interesting question I'm probably not qualified to answer around education, which is, how do we educate people if it's kind of the calculator problem? You know, calculators can do addition and subtraction, long division. Do we still need to teach people to do the long division? And I think my general answer to that is yes, we need to teach people these underlying concepts. Now, once you know how to do it and understand it and can do it by hand, if you had to, then fine, use the calculator for productivity. And I think that's the right answer for a lot of these tools, is you still have to learn these concepts around performance and efficient use of resource and security and all of these things. And we can then use the tools to make us much more efficient. On the flip side of that, though, I think there is also an opportunity for the tools to catch some of these problems. Like, even very good, experienced developers still write inefficient code, still write bad code, still write security flaws. I'm exceptional at writing bad code, right? I've been doing this a long time. It hasn't stopped me yet. You know, and I think the tools can play a part there in catching some of those things. And so I think both sides of that coin are equally likely. I don't think it's one or the other.
I think you've hit on the point I think there's two things going on here. One is this idea that you're leaning into the aspect that people still need to understand the foundational concepts, which I agree with. However, I would also argue that the Nash equilibrium of this is that everybody who can will. So even if you're not qualified, you're in the business, you've taken no foundational math courses, you still know how to use a calculator, I'm still going to use a calculator. Maybe I'm using it wrong and I don't know any different. And I think this is the challenge that with shareholder primacy, we've gotten so short-term oriented, myopic in general, of our trade-off and our risk-reward here. Any organization that lets more people develop, even if this ultimate solution is not resilient, they're going to win in the short term anyway. And so I think what's going to happen then is you're going to have a bunch of people who will recognize that, whether it be intellectually or just intuitively, and they're going to let everybody start developing everything because they can burn down their backlog faster. And this gets to the point where I think the job of the CIO becomes a lot more complex, because not only will you have your good developers developing more and just generating more lines of code, and I suspect there's a nice correlation between how many lines of code you have and the complexity and attack service that you have, so risk cyber, whether it be that, or just from a system design, stuff falling over and interacting in unexpected ways. But you now have introduced the additional risk of people who don't even know how to think like that, writing code and dumping it into your system. And so I think that you're right. I think long-term this gets resolved. I think long-term these tools get increasingly good at testing themselves. And I think we'll get to that here in a minute with what we've already seen some from Walmart and AI and cybersecurity. But in the short term, it's going to be really difficult because you're going to have, you know, if you just assume everybody's output is the same, you increase productivity by 50%, you have 50% more lines of code sitting in your system. And then you add the mix of like random people doing random stuff the way that shadow IT always has done random stuff and caused a variety of new risks in the organization. That gets compounded dramatically.
Well, I have two thoughts. One is I do think that the tools can help identify those and kick those areas and kick them up to someone more experienced and kind of work through it. But
in the short term, you're saying that?
Yeah, I think so in the short term. But I also think like, look, we tend to think of everything as like producing or writing code. The reality is what really good developers do is get rid of code. There's been many systems that we've worked on where we came in and it was 450,000 lines of code. And when we left, it was 200,000 lines of code. And it's a much more robust, reliable, stable, secure system that does more things. But someone had this expression one time that we shouldn't think of systems in terms of lines of code written, but in terms of lines of code spent. The smaller, the better. I guess what I'm saying there is more is not always better. I do think you're right. People will use these tools to create more.
I mean, I think it's a good point, but I guess you're actually reinforcing my argument, which is to say these tools are not currently designed to take my code and make it more efficient. These tools are designed currently to generate more code.
Right.
And frankly, again, if I were just me, let's say, and I showed up to someplace with 500,000 lines of code, and I wanted to do something relatively banal, integrate with Twilio, back to this example, right? There's probably some library in somebody's repo somewhere that already does that. Is it easier for me to go search all the code to find that or ask ChatGPT just to write me a brand new function to do that? And the answer is ask ChatGPT to write me a brand new function to do that. And so this is the risk that I'm saying. Equilibrium where everybody is individually incented to do the wrong thing. And yes, if we all collectively agreed, we'd be in a better state. But the way that this incentives at the moment are designed to actually create the worst possible outcome for everybody.
Yeah, sorry, I misunderstood what you were saying, which is, you know, we're going to have a lot of people producing things that are not very good because the tool will just write it. Maybe there was a better solution if we'd all gotten together and done things, quote unquote, correctly.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah, and I think that's true, but I would say that probably happens whether we use the tools or not. Now, maybe it accelerates it a little bit. I don't know. I mean, that is somewhat of the, I'll say, prevailing architectural style or development style. Recently, you know, you hear about microservices and the idea is like, well, let's break things into like very small pieces and have, you know, and that way we only have to replace one piece. That's true, but then you get a lot of duplicate pieces, or I get 100 pieces when 50 would have sufficed.
That's exactly right. But my point is now, if everybody in the business has the ability to write their own microservices, they
now
will.
Now you end up with 200 or 300 of them.
That's right. And now the job of a CIO is to figure out, how do I deal with this insanely complex environment? How do I manage that? How do I manage the risk? How do I just ensure reliability? What if I have to have a DR plan where I have to now copy not 50 services, but 2,000
services? And I don't even know where they are.
Exactly.
That's the challenge, right?
That's exactly right. And so this is my point is, we're seeing a lot of CIOs coming out and being like, no, there will be no ChatGPT or Copilot or any of these tools in our environment. And I think the heart of that is coming a little bit from exactly the space. They're saying, look, my own incentives are to keep this environment secure. And I'm not necessarily being judged against the difference in output or productivity, because there is no alternative state that I'm being compared to. I'm being compared to what I did last year or last month or last quarter. I'm staying flat or maybe increasing a little bit. Whereas I think some people realize, no, if I bring it in, I'll have a huge bump. And that's the baseline that I need to be compared to. And I think that no CIO is going to go tell their CEO, well, listen, my job gets a lot harder, but we can actually pump out a lot more of our backlog if only you make my job much harder. That's not really what anybody wants to say.
Right. I think of these things, as tools. And the fact that you now have a more efficient, faster power drill than using a screwdriver does not change the fact that whatever we're building needs to be properly designed up front, right? And I'll get to where I know where you're going to say, but let me get through okay, this thought first. So I would say, yeah, we still have to do the right design, architecture, things up front to define what components we need and don't need and what they should do and not do. And then we can use these tools to help us build them much, much faster. Just because we have these tools doesn't mean we should not do that first thing. Now, what your point is like, well, everyone will go do it anyway, right? That's the Nash equilibrium yes. concept, right? And you won't be able to stop it. And that's what, CIOs are locking down the environment. I would encourage you guys not to lock down the environment, but like figure out a way to use the power tools appropriately to speed things up without like everybody build their own cabinets.
I mean, you're exactly right. And I'll add one more nuance here that I think really highlights my point. Not only will you have these systems that grow at an incredibly unprecedented rate because everybody can do it now, and it's actually much easier to build anew than it is to reuse. But you're asking a stochastic process to go do that for you. Meaning, if I ask ChatGPT the same thing 5 times over, it may give me 5 different answers. Some of those answers are probably very standard answers that you would expect. Some of those answers may not be. And I think that this non-deterministic system adds a whole new complexity to the problem of code generation in general.
The non-deterministic part of this is a whole different topic that we need to probably talk, maybe we can talk about that for a minute in terms of output, in terms of generative AI, like not necessarily in terms of systems, but in terms of other things generated. It's like if you generate 2 images to test which one's better or not, like you won't know, right? You got to like measure the output. And so that there's that kind of non-determinism, but you're talking about the non-determinism of like, well, I generate the code. Is this the best way to write the code or not? Again, I think you're right. The tools will get better. Some bad, there's an old joke that you can write bad code in any language, right? Yeah, you can write bad code with any tool. A lot more people will write code, a lot more people will write a lot more bad code. And I tend to think those things get sorted out in the end. And that would be an argument I would say is for, again, back to advice for CIOs, like definitely use the tools, but don't use the tools without someone with enough experience and oversight to look at them to say like, yeah, that's really not a good implementation and that's going to cause some structural problems. We need to slightly tweak that. It's just like, anything else, you see people write essays or emails with ChatGPT. Well, they never take what's written straight out of the box. They go back, they tweak it, they make some changes, they ask follow-up questions. And, there's some knowledge that goes into shaping that, and it's used a tool. I'd say the same for developers. You still need those more experienced people to look at what comes out of these and shape that into the right thing and get rid of the things or rework the things that are not exactly right.
I'd actually take it one step further, if I may, which is to say, actually, so I agree with you on all those fronts, but I'd actually go so far as to say it requires an entirely new way of working. So back in the day, and this was your day, not my day, let's be very clear. We used to develop software in a waterfall methodology. you can talk about the characteristics of Waterfall. I'll let you do that in a second because you lived it. But the reason that we did that, I think, made a lot of sense. We used to have a solution, stamp it onto a piece of plastic, coat that piece of plastic with some metallic and call it a CD-ROM, put it in a box on a shelf in a store. And that's how we interacted with software. Then this thing called the internet showed up and everything changed. And that required us to change the way that we fundamentally worked as developers because we had the ability to do something entirely different. The way we developed code was different. The way we captured what was working was different. The way we could give updates was different. And so everything about that shifted. And my core belief is this is, again, another paradigm shift that will require an entirely new way of working, a post-agile way of working. But before I go there, maybe you can go through a little bit more of, like, in your experience as a developer or a CIO, like, in the waterfall methodology, like, what were the characteristics that were really good and strong that didn't actually port over to the modern web era that required agile? And then we can do the same thing from this world to the next world, if you will.
So it's really interesting that you mentioned waterfall. The ironic thing about that is that term was coined by a computer scientist named Winston Royce, who is of the Rolls-Royce family. And he wrote a paper, The Waterfall Process, which people have adopted. And they're like, oh yeah, look at this paper. We should follow this process like Mr. Royce suggested. But if you actually read the paper, he says in there, like, I don't think this will work for these reasons. And those, so everybody like read the first page of the paper, like, yeah, let's go do that. If they'd turned to the second page where it said like, this won't work because of all these problems, they would have maybe, history would have been a little bit different. I think that that is a factor of, again, the speed and velocity at which we could develop things. Like when software making even simple changes, because we had assembly or C and we didn't have all the, you know, tools, you know, even simple changes could take a long time. And we had to, again, like you said, print it on tape or
floppy
or CD and distribute it out physically to places. That there's a lot of effort in that. And like, well, let's only do that a few times, you know, a few times a year. It wouldn't have even been possible to do it more than, let's say, every 4 to 6 months.
Well, even the development, by the way, of the code itself. I remember at Microsoft, the people would talk about, like, they used to, like, every night they'd compile the latest version, take a little hard drive to all the different groups who needed to make modifications for that next wave. It's incredible.
Right. So I think two things, internet with the rise of web-based software, right? You know, internet as communication mechanism, but really it's more web-based solutions or solution software delivered over the web that allowed us to do one deployment to the website. And when we make a change, everybody got the change. And then I only had one thing to update and I could update it very easily and impact the change to a lot of people. That and, you know, a lot of people doing that and having to be more competitive and make changes faster than your competitors is what drove that kind of shift, you know, into being more agile, as well as, you know, that was not actually the genesis of the movement. The genesis of the movement was more just write better software, right? Sure. That does what people want.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you go and design software in a, you know, or design anything in a room for 2 years and don't get any feedback from customers or don't take into consideration changes in the environment for 2 years. Well, it's unlikely that that thing is going to do what users needed or wanted to do. And so that was really the impetus. But I think those other things, the, you know, competitive aspect and the ease and the cost are also drivers of it.
But I just want to point out on this point right here, it's so fascinating because, you know, I joined Microsoft in an era where the rest of Silicon Valley was already doing this agile deploy often thing. And Microsoft was still largely waterfall. They still really developed in these cadences on, you know, it wasn't 2 year development cycles, but it was still 6 months development cycles. And what was so fascinating is if you talk to these architects who had been around for many years by that point, they lived traditional like boxed software world, they would say, yeah, you know, the problem with Google and all these like crazy Silicon Valley is the products they ship are garbage. Just look at them. They don't even look pretty. They don't work right. It's good. We spend so much time designing and engineering the way you would any infrastructure project, right? The way you design a rocket, for example, or a road, or something that's going to take years to build and have to survive another decade on the scale of decades. To your point, they thought that was the best way. And I think, in fairness, I don't think they're wrong insofar as you will get a better answer if you spend a lot of upfront time designing and thinking and planning and really engineering the overall system. The challenge is what you just said. Even if you aimed perfectly, and I'm not saying they aimed perfectly ever, but let's just say they did, the targets moved. And so by the time you get there 2 years later, when you go to launch this thing, or even 6 months, the target's no longer where it was. And so you have to aim effectively in that case where you think the puck is going or the target is moving towards, and that's not practical. We're just not good at that. And so what we saw then was this evolution where, you know, if we look at the Office product specifically, Google was doing a great job with really crappy products relative to what the full fat client on Microsoft Office could do. But they were able to iterate really quickly and learn, to your exact point, what users actually wanted. And what they really wanted, we discovered very quickly, was collaborative editing of a document. That was the killer feature. Nobody cared about having, you know, Visual Basic in Excel or every function or whatever. They just wanted a place where they could collaborate in real time with another human that wasn't sitting at the same laptop as they were. And I think that was the big move that we learned very quickly. So I think that's a really good point.
I somewhat separate that from this, you know, agile idea in that, like, well, regardless of how you'd build software or what you use or these small, more frequent releases with feedback and incorporating that feedback and being able to pivot, change directions, continue to drop. The other thing we didn't mention is the cost of delay. You can get a lot of increased revenue by not delaying. If some feature can drive a 10% bump in revenue, but it doesn't release for a year because it's waiting on some other feature, right? That's a lot of money lost. That's the cost of delay. And so we can get rid of that. That needs to be done. Companies need to do that regardless. If you're not doing that, like, I think you're at a pretty substantial risk from the other, your competitors who are doing it. When it comes to the AI generated, like, it can help you do that faster if you're doing it. In other words, it won't make companies that are still in these long cycles, release cycles where we plan everything and, like, here's a roadmap of 12 months of features and we're not going to release until then. Okay, well, maybe it will help you build that faster, but it's not going to, like, instantly make you agile. I think the companies that are good at doing more frequent continuous releases, like, okay, well, those tools will have a measurable impact on getting those updates out faster, right? And comes in back, though, it's back to the, well, is it good or not good? Because you don't necessarily know what the AI is generating. So you might want to have things be a little bit more, you know, take advantage of things like the kind of canary release idea where I have something new, I'm able to send it out to a few number of people, test it, validate it, and evolve software rather than design or plan it up front.
I think that's exactly right, which is in the world of waterfall, we spent a lot of time doing user research. We'd pull people into labs, we'd show them stuff, we'd ask them how they do stuff, ask them lots of questions. And we learned that their stated and real revealed preferences didn't align the way we expected. And no doubt, there were great researchers and there were mediocre researchers, and the great probably got it slightly more accurate than the mediocre, but even the great were terrible. We know from testing on live production software that only 1/3 of the time do you get it right. Only 1/3 of your best ideas are actually what the customer wants. 2/3 are wrong. Even with all of those really robust muscles, we just weren't that great. Now, maybe, you know, a great company would do 1/3 right and a mediocre would do 1/4 or 1/5 right. So there was an improvement to be had there. It was still a value add, but it isn't where we could get to today. That's what led, I think, to your right, to the agile world. I agree with you that if you don't do any of it, you're still hosed. Sort of, I agree with you. Here would be my counterpoint, though. I think what's going to happen is, in the same way that we can now learn what customers do on, take Bing, for example, or Google with the 50 shades of blue, right? Or Bing with their same program on which exact background color. And I'll tell you, I saw that test. I was part of that team. No joke. If you look at them side by side, you can't see a difference. Like, they're so darn close. You couldn't ask a human which one they prefer. And yet the one they preferred was worth, on the scale of tens of millions of dollars more in annual revenue. It is a material shift to the bottom line for something that a human couldn't tell you objectively which one they prefer, but they do definitely prefer one over the other. In the same way that, like, that mindset of how do you test every color, for example, you don't prototype them, you don't choose two or three that your designers think are the best, you just go test 50 or 60 or 100 or whatever, and you find the one that is objectively the best. If all of that becomes easier, I actually think we're going to get to a world where it becomes easier to build entirely new applications and websites and effectively companies rather than features. So I can imagine a world where the average high school kid now can build an entire mobile app from start to finish over the course of a weekend. Somebody inside the business could build an entirely new website and all the backend services attached to it over the course of a couple of days. And if that's true, In the same way we've prototyped features in the past, we might prototype entirely new ideas, entire applications with full user journeys and flows and experiences built. I mean, I think the adoption rate has shown just how quickly this is. So Linza is a great example here where they generated $2 million a day of revenue in the first couple of days of launching, or Copilot got to 140,000 users paying $140 a month or $120 a month. It's incredible just how quickly these things are being adopted. And I think the reason for that is because the people see like, oh, there's this potential where I could skip all of our legacy, everything. I can effectively build an entirely new company with the tool and my idea, even though I'm not a developer. Now, does it scale? Is it resilient? Is it? I don't think it has any of the things today. And that I think that's where the CIO job becomes a lot harder, is if our marketing team says, hey, we're going to set up an entirely new blog website. It's GoDaddy plus ChatGPT and some, you know, I don't know, whatever tool comes out to build websites for you. Oh, and by the way, we're going to have a mobile app too, because people like mobile apps. Why not? And oh, and by the way, we're going to have this other thing over here too. Like, you can build the entire scaffolding, back end, front end as a marketer. Then I suspect that's what's going to happen. They're not going to go say, hey, Mr. IT, can you guys provision something on our website with a different domain? And I'm just going to buy some tool for $200 a month that builds the entire thing from the bottom up and hit enter.
Sure, but what's new, right? Well, that's always happened, right? Well, that's what the whole idea of shadow IT is, right? Yeah, and it's always happened. Now, your point is like, well, now it's going to happen a lot more and a lot faster.
But this is what's so new, is I think historically, we've done in pockets, we've done the thing where we try a bunch of ideas and we let users tell us which one they like the best. I think what's new now is that the entire business, everybody, with or without IT's help, can go do it from the top to bottom in a more robust and resilient way than they've ever been able to do before. And I think that shifts the rate of change and innovation within businesses.
I see what you're saying. I do think, take your example, we're going to go throw up an entirely new website. There's a couple of challenges with that. One is data, right? So great, I'll go throw up a new website, but which one works best? Right, which one achieves better goals? Like, did you put the right scaffolding around it to measure and say, like, well, people that go here convert this percentage, people that go to this one convert this percentage, like, and then from a brand perspective, do you want to have a different URL, or do you, whatever it may be, Expedia.com, I'm just picking that one up. Do you want to like new Expedia.com and hope people can find that and go use it? Or do you want it to come to Expedia and like let us control, like, well, let's put 10% to the new one. And like that kind of infrastructure like has to be built. Again, you can build it and maybe you can build it faster. There still has to be some controls around this kind of thing.
No, you've nailed it. No, you've nailed my point. This is exactly my point. In other words, this is what's going to happen. Good organizations will recognize exactly what you just recognized. That the only way this actually makes a difference is if we can measure the impact. The same way of like testing 50 different colors on Google only makes a difference if you can measure the impact. What it really means then is that the way we work today, the agile methodology probably won't work. The infrastructure designs we have today probably won't work. We have to think about this differently, where the single thread that ties all of this together is data.
Okay, the data guys are making it all about the data again. No, I'm just teasing you. No, you're exactly right, right? It is. We have to get, agile has been very much around measuring units that are delivered, right? Like we produce chocolate bars, now we produce more chocolate bars, right? We produce stories, now we, you know, more code, now we produce more features, we produce more. What you're saying is like, we've got to get to more data around like, hey, we want conversions. This one produces more conversions than that one, right? Yes. And I 100% agree. And that is a big change, not only in infrastructure, like there's an infrastructure change because you've got to have the systems to run those experiments, gather the data, report and make the shifts, right? In a more automated fashion, right? You can't like, well, this one makes us $10 million more than this one. Like, well, let's go to the change control board next month and before we implement that change. Like, no, you've got to like put them both there and let the automation route people. But my point is like, I agree with you. It's not just a shift, those systems and how they're designed and what the infrastructure you need, but it's a shift in how people approach. I think that's what you're saying. And I agree. It's a shift in how people approach process of defining software is like, we're going to go do this feature instead of like, well, here's 20 experiments which may impact revenue, and we're going to measure the ones that impact revenue and put them in production.
Yep, you've nailed it. And so I think this whole methodology is more about, less about how do we prioritize a backlog in real time based off whatever we've learned, and more about how do we let everything bloom everywhere and then strategically go trim the stuff that isn't working. It's really about shaping the growth that happens organically across the organization and pruning it down to give you the shape of the organization you actually want on this front. And so I think that's the big paradigm shift here. The other part of this that becomes really interesting then is, to your point, how do you measure correctness? You know, in a traditional world, you know what you're trying to build. So for example, if Sarah shows up, and I know she's pregnant, and she is turned to my website, I'm going to show her clothes that are relevant to a pregnant woman. That's great. I can write that rule. I can put her in a segment. No problem at all. What AI and machine learning allows us to get to in this simple example of marketing is true one-to-one. And so it's not that Sarah is a pregnant woman and I have a cohort or a segment for pregnant women. It's that Sarah is Sarah. And Sarah has lots of characteristics about her. And so the output, the thing I'm going to show her, I as the developer, don't actually know what that should be. It's based off a huge number of factors of how many kids or family or what does she typically buy and price point and colors and what's already in her wardrobe and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. To a point that I can't write the rules, and that's precisely why I'm using machine learning, because I don't know what the rules are. I couldn't articulate them with any accuracy or with any sort of clarity. The challenge then becomes from development, and I want you to speak on this, is like, how do you then write test coverage for your code? How do you deal with all of that?
Yeah, that's a great point. There are some things that we will still need to write tests to say that, yes, this performs correctly. But what performing correctly means may change, right? What before was performed correctly was, you know, we use the term deterministic and with our clients, right? Which is the sales tax is 8%. I create a cart. I go to checkout. It calculates the sales tax and it's my cart's $100. So my sales tax is 8%. Like I know the answer going in. And so we write tests where we say, yes, here's a bunch of input. We know the output. We got the output we were expected. We feel like this code is ready to go. And some of that still may exist, right? But for a large part of what you're talking about, more of these generative use cases, which is, hey, we need Sarah's at the website. We need an ad that's going to make Sarah is most likely to click on based on these millions of factors, some of which we don't even know what they are. So what does that test look like, right? Is your question. And I think the answer is, well, what we have to test is that we get a reasonable answer. Then we have the infrastructure in place to publish that answer for a certain segment of users, see if it performs better than, let's say, a control, right? We continue to iterate on that loop until we reach, you know, the goals that we're looking for, because we won't know. And so it'll have to be a somewhat live experiment, to use that term. And what we will have to test is that there are probably some big boundaries that we have to get an answer. Okay, check. It can't have pornography in it, you know, or bad language in it. Check. It shouldn't mention our competitors or other products. And by the way, we may even have to use AI to determine those things, right? Does this mention a product that we don't make, right? You know, we worked with a hotel company and it's like, well, does this to generate some content? And it's like, well, does it say that it has a pool when it doesn't have a pool? Those are the things we'll have to check, as opposed to here's four pieces of content. And if you meet these rules, you get this piece of content, right? And so that it is an entirely different approach to testing software. But back to the previous point on continuous delivery, companies have got to have that infrastructure to be able to deploy quickly and do those experiments rapidly, or they're going to get, you know, lapped by those that do. And it's funny that with all of the discussion around data and AI, and a lot of customers do come and ask us about data and AI, this is probably more, I've had more inquiries from customers in the last, I'll say, 3 months about some of these underlying platform and issues about like, how do we get agile and deploy things like weekly and that kind of stuff, than I have in the past probably 5 years. And I think that's because the savvy CIOs are starting to realize like, yeah, these tools are out there. We've got these opportunities. We can't operate like we have in the past. You know, even if it's agile, I'd say a lot of companies do agile and still don't deploy all that often.
This exact point that you just raised is what makes it so clear to me that agile isn't going to work, which is the thing that we're going to measure our own code on. Did it work or not work? It's going to require real user feedback in some sense. Maybe back testing too. You could back test on historical data to some degree. The challenge with that is, you can't predict when you will know, does it work or did it fail? You can guess a volume, you could estimate these things, but it depends a lot on what your test methodology is, but it might actually depend on the lift itself, of course, right? Like the bigger the lift, the sooner you can detect. And so that means that if something isn't working the way expected, your development cycle of 2-week sprints might be ridiculous because it might take 3 weeks or it might take 1 week or right. 1 day. And what you need to be able to do then, you know, from an organizational standpoint is develop in a way that accommodates these new constraints and these new opportunities that you have not had historically. This to me feels a bit like the physics world now, where we know underlying physical principles. Like if we take a physics example, think of photons, for example. These things, these beams of light effectively have no mass, but they have momentum. We know momentum is like mass times velocity. And so it's a relativistic momentum, so it's a little bit weird in this domain. But like what's interesting is how do you measure that? Well, like you can't measure it directly. Like I can't grab a photon out of the air and be like, what's your mass? What's your velocity? That doesn't work like that. And so what I have to do is I have to like shine a photon on some object and then see how much that object moves and assume conservation of momentum is a real thing. And then I can sort of infer the right behavior. Similarly, I won't be able to measure the algorithm directly. I can't say, oh, this is a good algorithm or this is a bad algorithm. I have to measure it by the reaction that people give to it. So for example, if my algorithm, my machine learning, my AI, whatever you want to call it, says, Sarah, you should like these things. I have to then see, does she buy those things in this case? And that's the thing I'm actually measuring, not the real model itself. And I think that's an entirely new way of thinking about how to develop code overall.
It is, but I think it's the right way. Some people might call that a second order effect, but I call it the first order, right? It's like what we should be measuring, right, in the first place. That's the point of the application. Whatever the application does, whether it sells things or it calculates the number of, you know, burgers I need to order for my restaurant, like getting that answer right, getting the answer that, you know, reduces costs, makes the most revenue is what we're after. We have in the past replaced that answer with a proxy. And that proxy was, is my algorithm working right? The point is like, well, yes, the algorithm's working right, but that may not be getting the thing you want. Now what we have is the opportunity to really think differently and say, well, I can generate a lot of these different tests, more than I could generate with a human. So maybe I can run a bunch of tests and figure out, instead of me trying to guess at the algorithm that gets the right answer, like let's just basically experiment a bunch of random ones and see which one works best. But we then are actually measuring the thing we care about. So I think it's actually what we should be measuring as software developers. Like we get into a real bad problem with software developers in terms of proxy measurements, like lines of code, you know, we talked about other lines of code written or story points developed or what are all these kind of silly metrics. Like those don't actually mean anything. Well, there are proxies for things that we think might be happening.
Yeah, I think it's really good. I think the challenge is that the reason, you know, somebody spent a lot of his career working on A/B testing stuff, the reason you see so many metrics pop up is that it becomes easier to debug if you have more metrics. And I think the challenge with this new paradigm is if you can't objectively measure, is my thing working or not, until you put it into production and say like, oh, it moved the needle or it didn't move the needle or moved it in the wrong way, that's going to be problematic in our current mindset as developers.
I agree. And we have to change our mindset.
Which is precisely why we need a post-agile methodology. Okay, here, it's not all bad though. Good news. It's not all bad.
It's not all bad.
The other thing that AI does, which it's quite fascinating, is it allows us to interrogate our own systems in a way that humans just wouldn't. They don't have the same constructs of what should be happening, the same definitions of what good looks like. And so they do things that we would never think to do. And that's particularly powerful in the realm of cybersecurity, for example. And so what you're seeing now is companies like Walmart finding that AI, with human control, of course, is incredibly useful in cybersecurity. And their point is exactly the same point we just made a second ago of why it's so powerful in an e-commerce example that I shared, which is if you think about Walmart, you know, they have some 11 billion lines of code, and cybersecurity tools generate some 6 trillion data points annually. And yet they still have to block some 8.5 billion malicious bots every single month. And what's remarkable about that is, of course, it's a cat and mouse game. So these people developing this malware, these bots, aren't stupid. They're not just copying and pasting what they saw online. They're constantly modifying and evolving and trying to find new vectors to attack that might work this time. And what's powerful about AI is it can continue to evolve too. In the same way, it can try showing new products to somebody, it can try and attack its own system in new ways or discover other people's intrusion in new ways. And so it automates a lot of that discovery process at an incredible rate, but more importantly, at a precision and a sort of personalized, if you want to use that word in this case, a personalized way that evolves with that bot. And so suddenly you don't have one rule for all bots. You can have a variety of rules for a variety of bots, and it's not human curated, but it's machine curated. And there's a lot of power behind what can be done by leveraging the fact that it's a bit more stochastic in its nature. It's not as deterministic. It's harder to predict what it's going to do. There's a great example from Uber that I can share too in a second. But any thoughts on that, Jason?
No, I think it's what we talked about up front. You know, not only will these two tools be good at generating, you know, new things, but also at evaluating those things for performance, security, and other things. And that doesn't just mean like static code analysis. I think it also means like at a runtime, like looking at runtime and identifying potential vulnerabilities. You know, the way we do that today is we threat model, we go and we say like, what are all the ways that someone could try to break into this? And we try to put a control, something in place to prevent that from happening. But do we think of them all? No, we never do. And, you know, if something were actively, you know, looking at it, and trying to figure out what those vulnerabilities were, you know, something like an AI that could do that, then it's much more likely to find things we wouldn't think about and, you know, potentially close them down. So I think that's an incredible use case. I'm quite sure there are a lot of companies, startups, and the big guys like Cisco and Palo Alto, you know, looking at that right now.
Well, this was an amazing episode. Thank you, Jason. I think that we saw there is a lot in this space evolving rapidly. I mean, everything from the good and the bad of AI writing code within organizations. There's going to have to be some trade-offs, some balancing with those things. We have to be sober in our recognition that we have both a Jevons paradox and a Nash equilibrium, which leads to a pretty difficult tension and a job that CIOs are going to have to deal with. It's not going to be an easy ride for the next while. And I think the ones who do it well will end up creating material strategic advantage for their companies, compared to those who don't get this right. And so this is a moment to really dig in and figure out how we're going to do that differently. And I think my perspective would be part of that is that we need to evolve our mind shift at minimum to agile, but I really and truly believe deep down that agile isn't going to work in this world. And then we're going to have to evolve the way we develop code to account for all this extra complexity that we don't have, that we now have in AI. Again, it's not all bad. There are a lot of ways that you can use this non-deterministic nature of AI to your benefit, actually. And so it's not just complexity and downside. There's actually a lot of upside that can come from it too. And we can exploit that to our benefit when trying to solve adversarial attacks in the cyber world or just finding bugs in our own code that we wouldn't think to check. I think there's a lot of opportunity here, but you heard it here first. This is a paradigm shift. No, I'm sure you didn't hear it first, but it really is from my perspective. This will be the thing that will change the way we do everything in business forevermore.
You know, and what's funny is like or at least you accuse me of being the old curmudgeon and just like looks at every new technology and goes, oh, that'll never work. You know, oh, that doesn't work. Oh, that's not going to be a big deal. Like it is very rare that I see something where I do think like, wow, that's a fundamental shift and will have a significant impact for maybe decades. And thought that about cloud and mobile and that's about it over the years. So the PC.
We should definitely do that thing where other podcasts, you know, we pull up quotes from ourselves saying how great blockchain is. No, right. We're not huge fans of blockchain back there, crypto or things.
Metaverse or any of those things, right? But I do think this one does have legs, so to speak.
In other words, you're not just a hype guy.
No, I'm definitely the anti-hype guy.
But this one is real. So again, I'm with you on this. I'm usually pretty skeptical. I am skeptical insofar as I don't think it's going to do everything people say. Is there a real risk it could take over the world? Possibly. Do I think that's realistic? No, probably not. But it's a big enough risk that it's worth thinking about. It's worth contemplating. And I don't think it's enough to scare us away from moving towards this personally. I do think it's going to be transformational though for businesses and those who are reluctant to move here. I mean, to your point about the infrastructure part. I've been talking about generative with our clients now for 18 months. I've been running around pitching this stuff for some time since ChatGPT-3. Most of them thought it was cute, but like that's some future problem. Just in a year, it's amazing how much that I get these calls almost every day now from different clients like, hey, what does this mean for us? I want you to come give us a briefing on the latest trends in AI, et cetera, et cetera. And that's great. I mean, that's really, really good. What I'd say is be realistic about what it can actually do. It's not fully baked. You can't just tomorrow automate your entire company. That being said, you need to be sober about the fact that this is going to change the way your business works. And you do need to get started now. Maybe not with everything, maybe not all at once, but you do need to get started now because it will be a different way of working. It requires a different thinking, there's a huge amount of change management, said differently. And it's important because it really will be a game changer.
Some of these foundational pieces that I talked about, right? You know, the ability to deploy quickly and measure and adjust. Like if you don't have that, right, that's your first step and you need to do it quickly.
Yeah, that's right. Again, thank you so much, Jason. I really appreciate it. For those who would like to learn more, please visit the insights page at cordera.com. Again, thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join us again. Bye-bye.